Okay, good morning, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Welcome to this last lecture of the time series course. And today we are going to be discussing about perhaps the most advanced models in the family of time series models regarding the applications to financial market data, but also perhaps the most intuitively relevant in current or modern market data. Because as we discussed yesterday, there are lots of things that have probably changed the data generating processes or of the time series that we are nowadays analyzing in financial market related to the financial market variables. And for example, the global financial crisis has introduced a huge structural break or change to the relationships between the variables. So today we are going to be discussing about these smooth transition models and the at the final as the final or the last application or family of models. We are going to be discussing about the Markov switching models, and you will be applying these things on in the final demonstration next Monday. So yesterday we ended up here to the discussion of this example paper about currency markets, and actually these are very relevant for you to now to get some kind of grip on these models, because you will be focusing on using currency market data in the demonstration number 5 next Monday. So we were discussing about this, or I gave you instructions to take a look at the results of this Chappell and others paper in Journal of Forecasting that is using the daily data from 1990, May, 1st of May in 1990 until last of March in 1992. And this is an interesting period for the European market data, because this is just before the, for example, floating of the Finnish marka in autumn of 1992, and the European markets were, or the countries were, experiencing a period of convergence in terms of the requirements for the third state of the European Monetary Union. So, for example, the main currencies, the French franc, and Italian lira and German mark were actually the ones, and the Spanish currency also were the ones that were the so-called main currencies or the core currencies, the biggest countries within the European Union. And they were during this convergence period that basically started already from 1990. And it lasted until the third stage of the European Monetary Union, beginning of 1999. The main currencies were allowed to move within a band of 2.25 percentage points regards to the central parity. So each currency were calculated a historical basis for their central parity against each other based on the history of the trading activities and so on. So the weighted currency values were used as the central parity value. And within that, around that value, these currencies were allowed to vary by 2.25 percentage points. If they were so under some kind of pressure to be increasing the value of the currency or lowering the value of the currency, then the central banks were required to do activities and intervene in the currency markets. So basically, this was normal variation. So this was kind of a managed floating, but it's not the same thing as the actual floating. For example, the Finnish marka was allowed to float in from October 1992, because the speculation against our currency came so strong towards that period of time, the whole exchange rate mechanism in the European level actually experienced a period of high speculation just before October 1992. For example, the British pound lost its value by tens of percentage points within very short periods of time. So there were high speculation whether this new currency union is reliable at all. So basically, these guys are not focusing on that period at all. So they are focusing on a period of perhaps more tranquil era of the valuation in the main one of the main currencies, French franc against the German mark. These are the things that you always have to discuss when you start using these kind of models. We are just not using these models for the sake of introducing fancy models, fancy statistical models to the behavior of some variable in the financial markets. You always have to have some kind of economic reasoning why it is relevant to do these analysis using these models. So basically, these ideas about managed floating period for the French franc against marka, German marka, gave the researchers an idea that perhaps it would be something that can be characterized, the relationship between these two currencies can be characterized as a self-exciting threshold autoregressive model. So they wanted to analyze whether there is a threshold value for this currency and whether there are more than one threshold values. So basically, can anyone give me an idea that why would a three state or two threshold Setar model be valid? What are the thresholds here that would be of interest in terms of using a three state two threshold model?
One threshold could be when the currency is minus 2.25% value, and the other when it's plus 2.25.
Yeah, so you have these two thresholds, but what about the states? How can you define that you would be in three states? You are in the right track in a sense that one of the states perhaps could be the one that is close to the value of zero. So when you are at the central parity or close to that, that could be one state. And then the other thresholds might be, or the states could be the ones that you, when you are close to the upper limit or the ceiling, and when you are close to the lower limit or the floor. So basically, in that case, you could be in a three state model, but using a three state model. But this was not actually proved to be not a relevant model. They tried, they started actually from this case, but it was not proven to be a relevant model because the Deutsche Mark, German Mark, it was never basically a weak currency at that time. So against the French franc, it did never, the value of French franc against German mark did never go close to the minus 2.25% level below the central parity. So basically, they were able to sort of start right from the beginning, start to analyze a two state model. So one regime could be the relevant one. They also experimented in the out of sample exercise, actually forecast exercise. They experimented with this larger model, but it was something that was basically perhaps right from the start in economic terms, it might not have been even relevant to try. As I have already emphasized in all the cases or all the models that we have been discussed here, start from the economic reasoning. Why would you be focusing on some phenomenon regarding this data? Why is it relevant, for example, to focus on certain values of that variable that you are interested about? Okay, so they started to use this and the ceiling in log terms. Remember that it's always useful to use log values for the levels, because if you want to calculate the returns, then it's easy to calculate the continuously compounded returns based on the log differences. And multiply that by 100, then you get the percentage values for the continuously compounded returns. So in their out-of-sample exercise, one of the main reasons for using these very sophisticated models is always to analyze whether they are useful in forecasting out-of-sample. And they did the out-of-sample exercise by using first the 450 observations for the estimation. So that was the in-sample, and then the remaining 50 to compare the ability of the model that is entailing also this SETAR modeling to forecast the future value. So always when you calculate the forecast statistics, you compare to the actual values at the forecast intervals. So when you're generating one step ahead or one day forecast, compare that forecast to the actual one day ahead observation. And in this case, you are interested about the French franc, its valuation against the German mark. So forecasts are then produced using the threshold model. SETAR modeled with two thresholds also. So basically they are also experimenting with this three-state model, but it was basically something that was also already in sample, the parameter estimates for the third state or third regime were not statistically significant. So basically they are doing an unnecessary experiment there also, but they wanted to allow for this possibility. And then there's a random walk model and then an AR2 model. Just out of the blue, they took an AR2 model also because they found out that in one regime, AR3 is actually relevant and random walk is in another regime. So AR2 is actually kind of a natural choice to experiment against these models too. So as you see from already this example, this is very much like playing a trial and error thing. What is the best representation of the data? And can you actually use that information in terms of parametric representation of the model for out-of-sample forecasting performance? So start always from the look at the data, eyeballing of the actual series that you are interested in. This looks like an interesting series. What can you say about the non-stationarity of this series? Just already before doing any kind of unit truth tests, might this series actually contain unit truths?
Yes, it might.
Yeah, so what is your indication from that? Can you even
So,
so yeah, continue.
it's not stationary.
So it's not stationary, so can you use even any kind of models for the levels?
No, I would have to use the differences.
Yeah, exactly. But now, once again, you have to go back to the actual phenomenon that you are analyzing. You are analyzing a valuation of the currency. So probably, for example, from the point of view of the central bank, if it wants to have an effect on the valuation of its domestic currency, then it probably is not focusing on the changes on of the value, but the actual value. What is the value of the currency? So it's focusing on the levels. And for this period, actually, because there was this, based on this exchange rate mechanism in the European area, or euro area, forthcoming euro area, the currency was not allowed to fluctuate more than 2.25 percentage points above or below its central parity. So this is a very much a restricted, this is a bounded variation in the variable that you are interested. So basically, it should never have been the case that the depreciation of the value of the currency would go very much above this 2.25%, or at the lower end, it should not go very much below minus 2.25%. So it's a boundary. It's a bounded variable. So a bounded variable obviously cannot basically contain a continuously increasing observations and continuously lowering observation. So based on economic intuition, it is actually relevant to assume that within such a short or small sample of observations, it's not relevant to assume that it really is, in economic terms, a non-stationary. Even though clearly, when they did the unit truth tests for this series, the ADF test statistics revealed that it is non-stationary. So basically, you should be using differenced forms. So you should be using actually returns. But because the economic reasoning gave them sort of a background or clear enough indication that it's actually relevant to focus on the value or the level of this series, they continued with the levels. But be careful in your own research with this thing. For example, in the Monday demonstration, you will be using same kind of data. You will be using currency valuation of the main three currencies against the USD, US dollar. And we have no these kind of managed floatings. All the currencies are floating freely. So you don't have limits for the valuation. So obviously, if you find unit roots in the levels, you should be using the differenced values, because it's very difficult to find an economic reasoning why couldn't it be possible basically that within such a huge sample, actually, that you will be using about 5,000 observations, it should be actually possible that the data generating process for the currency valuation is actually a non-stationary thing. So you will be mainly basically focusing on the returns on next Monday's application or the demonstrations. Okay, so what about the results? What can you say about the relevance of the models? So these time series or these AR representations in each regime were based on using Akaike information criteria. Model errors for each regime are determined using Akaike information criteria. Are these relevant models? What is the model for the first regime? And the numbers in parentheses, they are standard errors. So they are not t-statistics. T-statistics can be calculated based on dividing the estimated parameter estimate for here, for this term, for example, by the standard error. So you get the t-statistics. If it's bigger than 2, then you have clearly statistical significance there. So what kind of model, what kind of AR model is this one?
AR1.
Yeah, and the parameter estimate is actually quite close to 1. So what kind of specific model for AR1 representation is this actually? This is actually now giving you clearly the idea that in the first regime, when we have the threshold value that gets to be estimated from the data to be 5.83, so it is below the upper threshold value. So it's about 1.55 percentage points above the central parity value. And in that case, you are actually dealing with a random walk model with drift. So basically, you have a non-stationary series there when you are having the observations for the French franc against the Deutsche Mark at the below of 5.83 in log terms. What about the second regime, What kind of representation do we have there?
AR3.
So yeah, here we have an AR3 model, and actually when you sum up all the parameter estimates here, it's lower, the sum is lower than for this drift or this random walk with drift case. So basically you have a stationary model in the second regime when the valuation of the French franc against Deutsche Mark, the previous period valuation is always bigger than 5.83 in log terms. And the interesting thing here is always that you should be also interested about the number of observations. So basically this below threshold level seems to be dominating in the whole data because you have the number of observations for those regime observations is 344. And in the upper case, you have only 103. But nevertheless, there are more than 15% of the total observation of the variable or the observations here that are in either of the regimes. So this is a relevant specification. There's enough information to estimate reliably these parameter estimates also in the other regime because the number of observations is 103. So you just estimate endogenously the threshold value using a Setter model for this valuation of French franc against Deutsche Mark. And then after that, when you have been able to specify the threshold value, just take a look at the number of actual observations that are above that and the ones that are below that. Then you get an idea about the frequency of observations that are in both of these regimes. And as I already mentioned, one of the main purposes of these models is to use them for out-of-sample forecasting purposes. So they are now experimenting with the random walk. So they are estimating as an alternative representation for the 450 observations, they are using this random walk, and then they are using AR2 as an intermediate case between this AR1 or random walk and the AR3. Is it relevant to actually to use only an AR2? So this is a linear model. And these two non-linear models. So they tried also these two threshold models, but in terms of the out-of-sample forecast performance, so they are estimating for the first 450 observations, and then they generate always one step ahead, and two steps ahead, and three steps ahead, and 1 week ahead, which means five steps ahead, and 2 weeks ahead. So 10 steps ahead in daily data. So which one of these would seem to be the best model in terms of out-of-sample forecasting? So for those of you that have never seen this e to the power of minus 0.07 means that here you multiply this coefficient by the 10 by 10 to the power of minus 7 in this case, and minus 6 in this case. So the bigger is the exponent here, the lower is the actual value of that whole number there, obviously. So you should get, in terms of the out-of-sample forecast performance, when you are using a mean squared forecast error, so you calculate the mean value for the comparison of the forecasted value and the actual value, square those always, and then calculate the mean of those observations. It's actually fairly straightforward to do in Excel or any of these programs. And the R and Stata, for example, report you readily the statistics if you want to calculate those. And also in RATS, it's very easy to do. So which one of the models would seem to be the best one in terms of the mean squared forecast errors?
One and two threshold setters.
Yeah, and which one would you prefer if you take a look at all the forecast horizons? Which one would seem to be the dominating one?
The two threshold setter seems to be a little bit worse.
Yeah, exactly. Because here you have in the decimals, you have a difference. You have the same number of zeros right after the decimal point here. So you have the same number of zeros, but the actual value 5.34 is a bit smaller than 5.61. You get to try to get to the smallest possible. So basically, it seems to be that one threshold setter model is actually quite good. And it's a rare finding in the currency market data, actually, that the random walk is also being beaten, gets to be beaten by using these nonlinear models, because random walk seems to be, in many cases, the one that gives you the best possible forecasts. But here it seems to be the case that it is actually not. So the main message from this is when you are using mean squared forecast error as the statistics for the forecast ability, the main message seems to be that it is relevant to model the behavior of this currency value using a setter model with a one threshold. And the relevant threshold seems to be somewhere between the central parity and the upper limit of the valuation. What about when you are using median squared forecast error? So this is a median.
One threshold setter seems to be the best, even though random walk is better at forecasting first and two steps.
Yeah, exactly. Random walk seems to be the one in the shortest term forecasting exercises, but once again, also using this median. So you just organize the observations for the forecast error, squared values of forecast errors to an increasing order, and then take the median value of that. And then compare those. It seems to be the case that also here, basically, the one threshold setter model is actually dominating. But in one of the that paper is actually this Chappell and others paper is actually one of the examples where for all the other main or the core country currency valuation pairs, they actually were not able to get these kind of results. So only for this French franc against Deutsche Mark or German Mark, they were able to get this usefulness of setter model to be the clear indication. And in none of the other cases for the core currencies were they able to do that. And one of the reasons for that has been argued late in later studies that basically these models are very, very sensitive to the possibility that the model is forecasting actually the next period regime exactly the wrong way. So even though if it's forecasting that we will be there in the first regime in the next period, the actual case might be for some reason or other, if something happens in the data, suddenly that you are in the other regime. So then in that case, obviously, the model more or less collapses. It's using the wrong forecasting model to forecast the autosample observations. When it's ending up to a situation that you should be in the first regime and it's still using the actual regime is the second regime. So it's using a random walk model, even though it should be actually using an AR3. So actually, it's fairly intuitively understandable that in those cases, the forecasted values get to be strongly biased. So they are absolutely wrong. So basically, it can be the case that these results or these models are very sensitive to the actual modeling of the regime. Where are you in real life? But it has been proven that, for example, for a lower frequency data like monthly and quarterly data also, these models actually are performing quite well. So these are worth to be tried when you try to forecast the financial market values, let's say financial market variables, let's say at the weekly and monthly frequencies. So these setter type of model or smooth transition and other models might be relevant to do there. So this is a nice example of that. And actually in that same journal, Chris Brooks later published a paper using this exactly same data. And he was using a GARCH model. So he was using a regime change model for the volatility of these. So he took care of this presence of unit roots and focused completely on their return series for these currencies. And he modeled the volatility of the returns using a GARCH model and applied this smooth transition or threshold autoregressive model for the GARCH. And he was actually able to produce better forecasts also for the other currency pairs in using that. So it's actually very relevant to take care even in this short sample where you have this managed floating. It's actually relevant to take care of the unit root property. So it's not a nonsense thing when you try to do your analysis. Usually it's the case that if you find a unit root in the data, these setter type or threshold autoregressive models might not be working, but the GARCH models actually might be working. And actually you can get a similar kind of result from the demonstration or the more recent data for the major currencies that you will be doing in the demonstration number 5. Tomorrow you will be have the question sheets tomorrow and the data and the goals to start doing the things and trying to experiment with these models. And Juha, Matti and Alexandra will go through in details the results on Monday. So basically the other possibilities are, we have now been discussing about self-exciting threshold autoregressive models. So excitedness here means that you are using as the threshold variable for which you try to calculate the threshold value, the past observations of that individual variable that you are focusing on. So you are not using kind of exogenous information or other information from any other variables, but it is possible to do. And before that, actually, you can actually also do this. We have been now analyzing this in kind of a stepwise breakwise framework. So there's no reason to assume that the structural changes would always induce a strong step or jump in the observations. Basically, these threshold ideas give you an indication that it should be a jump-wise change in the variable. So Timo Teräsvirta and Clive Granger have actually introduced these threshold autoregressive models that are now allowing a smooth transition behavior. So it's not a stepwise or jump-wise change in the series, but it's more like a smoothed change. So it doesn't come up within one or two periods. It comes based on more, a bigger number of periods when the effect to the analyzed variable basically realize in full force. So in financial market investors, in financial markets, investors do not react to new information exactly at the same time and in the same way. They might be reacting to that with a different dynamics, basically. So some of the participants might be reacting a bit later compared to the other ones. So there's no reason to believe that the total reaction would be something like a jump-wise reaction, that all the participants react exactly the same point of time to the new information. So this actually introduces, in practical terms, the need to capture this kind of behavior in parametric way in these models. So the movement from one regime to another is slow, and it's often highly nonlinear. So you want to give a function kind of functionalized representation for this movement. And actually, this is one of the parts where in the main course book that we are using, this Brooks book, these models have not been discussed in such details that we are discussing here in these slides. And the main reason for that is that actually I'm a bit home biased guy in these respects, because I'm a big fan of these models, because Timo Teräsvirta and Ritva Luukkonen are famous Finnish statisticians that have actually been focusing on these things very carefully. For example, Ritva Luukkonen is now working at the Finnish Occupational Research Health Institute, Työterveyslaitos in Finnish, and she's one of the sort of a leading stars in the smooth transition models with Timo Teräsvirta. And she's a good example of a researcher that is working outside academia, and she's heavily using these models all the time to model the behavior of the occupational health factors in her everyday working duties. So these are very much applied, these models, and Timo and Ritva are the ones that are perhaps leading also. They are among the best researchers in these terms. So if you want to take a closer look at these papers and these studies, then go to Scopus and Google for Ritva Luukkonen. Chris Brooks in his book is not even mentioning Ritva Luukkonen and not even Timo Teräsvirta at all, and they are the leading researchers. So take a look at these guys' research in Scopus, for example. Timo has introduced this with, he actually cooperated with Tong and Clive Ranger quite heavily on these models at the beginning of 1990s. And they just introduced these STAR models. They wanted to allow the reactions to be kind of a smoothly changing, not like a stepwise change that the past observations would have on the current observations. So it's just about decision whether you are in the regime one or you are in the regime two, not like that. It can be a smoothly changing probability, basically. So the more you get observations regarding the possibility that you would be in the first regime, the more likely it is actually that you are there. So that's the main sort of intuition in these models. So they just give these parametric representations or the functional representations for these smooth transition autoregressive STAR models. And once again, obviously, you can start from the idea that this S variable that is governing the basically the probability that this process is in certain regime, it is allowed to be also something else than this actual modeled variable YT. So for example, if you are focusing on the probability using smooth transition models, you are focusing on the idea that you might be in a negative interest rate period for the Euribor 12-month interest rate. You have been there for a period of several years already, but you want to include the idea that Eonia interest rate, the overnight interest rate that went to the negative side earlier, might actually indicate the probability of moving towards then the negative area in the 12-month interest rate. That would be relevant information. So you can impose in this smooth transition autoregressive STAR model, you can impose that Eonia information. So in that case, this ST here is not the 12-month Euribor, but it's the Eonia. The past information from Eonia gives you an idea about the probability of going to the negative era in the 12-month Euribor interest rate. So there is a parameter that governs the change or the movement, the smooth movement towards that regime in the 12-month interest rate, and there is a threshold value for the Eonia. When Eonia goes below zero, it will induce more probability also to the 12-month interest rate that it will go below zero. This is actually something that I would very much like some of you to start doing more analysis, whether you can use these smooth transition models applied to the European term structure of interest rate data to give an idea whether the shortest term interest rates are able to forecast the probability of the longer term interest rate to move towards positive era, because that positive era is something that we would very much like to go in terms of getting towards more normal periods of interest rates in money markets. You could perhaps try these smooth transition autoregressive models for that. So this is just a nice parametric representation of this model. So the point here is that some of the autoregressive part or the linear coefficients in the linear representation of the part of the model may be zero. So the order of the AR parts of the regimes does not have to be the same once again. So once again, this allows for the possibility that in another regime you have an AR1 and in the other regime you have an AR4 or something like that. So these are very flexible models, and that's the reason why I'm kind of a big fan of these models, because they don't impose the same structure for each and every regime for the AR models. So on the right-hand side, you can include these exogenous variables, and that is the interesting part for me. Obviously, also in the interest rate data, it might be relevant to include the information of the 12-month Euribor rates from the past history when the trend starts to change, whether it is able to help in forecasting when we are going to reach once again the positive era of the interest rates. That would be interesting to do. So basically you can do this using these smooth transition models also. So this exogenous possibility to use the S variables, the exogenous variables, the other information is the one that is of most interest here in these models. Residuals are assumed to be white noise, random walk processes, often assumed to follow the normal flow of the normal distribution, but normality is not a necessary condition. You can impose a distribution, you can use a skewed distribution or t-distribution if you have reasons to believe that the residuals even from a very well fitted model would not still be normal. So you would have to take that into account in the estimation procedure. So you can choose the distribution, whether it is T distribution or skewed T distribution or something else. And you just adapt the parameter estimates to take into account that the change in the distribution of the residuals in the error term or the behavior of the error terms. The function G is the transition function. S is an observable transition variable triggering, so it's a trigger variable that triggers the changes between the regimes. C is the estimated threshold for that. So for example, in that interest yielding or money market interest rate example, you would be interested about modeling the probability of 12-month interest rate to go below zero. Conditioning information is the Eonia interest rate that went zero, below zero, the first interest rate from the money market interest rates in October 2014. And you would be interested in the near future about the possibility that will we ever reach this positive era for these interest rates, based on the history that you also have information from the area of positive interest rates, obviously. There's probably no possibility to go back to positive era if you only have interest rate observations from the negative era. You should understand, obviously, that you should have observations from both these regimes, the number of observations to be big enough from both these. So the function here, the main idea here is that G function, that transition function, is continuous and it's bounded between 0 and 1. So in the logistic case, you can give a representation for that functional form in this form. So this is 1 plus E, which is the root of the exponent of the log base for the natural logarithm. It's e to the power of minus gamma times st, and in this st can be either the actual variable that you're interested about or some exogenous variables. But nevertheless, this C thing here, this C value, dress value, gets to be estimated for this S. So that is the relevant information. When this S experiences values in some threshold, it has a different effect on the Y compared to the situation when the S variable is in another regime. And the transition between these regimes is smooth. That's the basic idea in these models. So in this case, it's a logistic smooth transition model. And if the model is an autoregressive model, it means that the S variable here is the actual Y variable that you are focusing on. And when the smoothness parameter, when this gamma parameter approaches infinity, you are actually approaching this threshold case. So it's not a smooth transition anymore. It's a stepwise change in that case. So it's actually very relevant also to estimate this smoothness parameter. How big is? The bigger it is, the more likely you are actually, you should be using a threshold model that is not a smooth transition model. So it's a stepwise change in the threshold variable. So in this case, instead of a smooth transition, there will be a jump from one regime to another. This implies that the threshold autoregressive and setar models are special cases of the logistic smooth transition model. So when this gamma parameter goes towards infinity, the likelihood that actually you should be using a stepwise function here goes bigger and bigger. So it's not actually useful to capture the past smooth behavior of the threshold effect in a parametric way in this case. So when you have the case where this threshold or the smoothing parameter gets the value of zero, then this threshold function gets actually the value of 1/2. So the model becomes a linear model in that case. So non-linearity, test of linearity against non-linearity is basically a test for the value of this smoothing parameter, whether it is zero or not. So basically the null hypothesis in when you are using the test likelihood ratio types test, for example, the existence of non-linearity is simply this, that whether this smoothing parameter is zero or not. When it is zero, you have a linear model. So the test for the non-linearity involves a null hypothesis of having a linear model. And the null hypothesis is equal to testing for the value of gamma, whether it's zero or not. And the other possibility is this exponential function. Don't pay too much attention. Why are these functions like this? Just rely on the work by Timo, Teräsvirta, and Anderson, and Ritva Luukkonen, for example, and Tong, actually, originally, that these are the best possible functional representations for this smooth transitionness in these nonlinear models. These are the most useful. In this case, the smooth transition function looks like this. It's an exponential transition function. So in the autoregressive case, once again, we are discussing about exciting exponential smooth transition autoregressive model. And the E star model does not basically nest with the setar models because setar models are not special cases of these exponential smooth transition models, actually. So the exponential transition function has this form in that case. But nevertheless, once again here, the key thing here for testing for the existence of nonlinearity is to test for the possibility that this guy here, this lambda guy, this gamma guy, gamma parameter is equal to zero or not. So you always start from the idea whether the linear representation of the model is enough or not. Is it useful to try any kind of nonlinear form to the data? The choice between the various nonlinear representations is the next step. The first step is always to test for the linearity against nonlinearity. So smooth transition models from these family of these models, the logistic one is perhaps the more popular than the exponential function. And they can be generalized to have, instead of one trigger value, you can actually generalize this to have more than one. So basically you can have even n triggers, but I always want to sort of emphasize here to the students that you obviously should have economic reasoning to consider many trigger values. What is the economic reasoning to consider more than one or more than two trigger values for the variable that you are interested about? In case of, for example, the ERM or the exchange rate mechanism period data for these currencies in the European monetary system before the euro, these managed floating period was actually the thing that introduced also the possibility that the trigger values could be, there could be more than one trigger value, not just central parity, but also the ceiling and the floor values for the valuation of the currency. So always take a look at the economic reasoning first. What is the relevant number of possible trigger values in the data series that you're interested about? So logistic star model can be generalized in the following way to incorporate several regimes. So basically you can have these several regimes around different values of the threshold values. So it looks like this. So basically we can add a third regime there with the same transition variable, but different smoothness parameter. So obviously the point here, if you want to analyze more than two regimes, is that in the third regime, you should get parameter estimates that are statistically significantly different from zero. If not, then it's not worth to try to estimate the model using more than one threshold value for the trigger variable or the threshold variable. So here we have added a second smoothness parameter, that is this gamma 2. So we have gamma 1 and gamma 2 and the associated threshold value, and created a three regime model with one transition variable ST. So the same transition variable is getting values that are relevant, different values that are relevant to the Y value in different representation or different regimes. So basically you are able to add this kind of non-linear part to any kind of regression model when you are able to somehow give economic reasoning that you should have a trigger variable, threshold variable, that affects also on the role of the explanatory variable in determining the values of the dependent variable. So this is actually quite sophisticated or quite complicated non-linear relationship, and you should always use economic reasoning why you want to model this using this kind of representation for the regression model. So we can also extend this model to have several transition variables. So it gets even more complicated when you have a bigger set of transition variables. In that interest rate example, for example, we might have a case where we are interested also the additional role that the shorter term money market interest rate Euribor rates have for the 1 year, 12 month Euribor rates probability to be in certain regime. So we are now including also the possibility that the relationship or the information from Eonia when it went negative is relevant there. When it is there in the negative regime, it's relevant. But in addition, also the 1 month maturity and 3 month maturity might be relevant to determine the probability of 12 month maturity to be in the negative area. I hope that you get the idea of this, that you can basically introduce any kind of model to this smooth transition modeling. But the main thing is there that here we actually are using the idea of the term structure of interest rate models. So the relevant information comes for the longer term maturity interest rate. It comes from the shorter term maturity interest rates. So the expectation hypothesis of the term structure of interest rates is holding one way or other, but it's holding differently in the era of negative interest rates compared to the era of positive interest rates. I hope that someone of you would grip or get this idea and do some kind of analysis for this behavior, because it's really interesting. I would like to know when the term structure of interest rates could be giving us an idea that we would be able to come back to the normal, more normal times with respect to the behavior of the short-term interest rates. The normal times refer to the case where we have positive interest rates. And are we able to extract that information, for example, using smooth transition model for the term structure of interest rate data? Very interesting theme for any of you to be doing in your master's thesis. One extension of these multiple regime smooth transition models would be use a so-called time-varying star models. You can basically estimate these. I should actually warn you already here that these smooth transition models in general are perhaps a bit more easier to estimate using STADA compared to R. And the interpretation of the results is actually much more easier using STADA. So that is the reason why in the demonstration, actually, Alexandra will be going through. Alexandra gives the STADA experiments and examples, and Juha-Matti gives the R examples, and Alexandra will be discussing about how to estimate these with the STADA program. So you can estimate this as a time-varying star. So you get even more letters to this representation of these models. But the main idea here is that you just use the threshold variable as the threshold variable, the time. So you have the time observation from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on up until, for example, 500 in that case that we actually analyzed here, discussed earlier. So use that as the threshold variable. It's relevant to find out what is the time period that has caused this threshold change, actually. So in the multiple regime star model, we will have a time-varying star model in that case. So the time can be, for some reason or other, the time can be actually relevant also to be extracted as what is the relevant period of time when we experienced a structural change in this model, and its smooth transition in nature. So basically, the adaptation of the process started already before that threshold point in the time. So it started already that, and it continued also a while after that. But the relevant point of time is relevant. There's a reason to try to extract the relevant point of time. So Granger and Terasvirta are the other guys that are, to me, are the leading researchers in this area. And they start the modeling cycle or the modeling phases, steps in these star models by first specifying always the linear model. So the linearity is the one that we would prefer. Basically, these non-linearity or regime changes are things that disturb us. They disturb the interpretation of the linear model. So that is the reason why we want to somehow be able to parameterize the effect of these non-linearities. After that, we test, after we have specified a relevant linear model. So usually we use information criteria, as we have been doing that in all the cases here in the previous lectures also. After that, we will test for the null hypothesis of linearity against the nonlinear alternative. So we have already observed that if we find nonlinearity, then we are basically in troubles. We will start to we will have to start to figure out the form of non-linearity. And it can be various forms. We just have to try to find the best possible form of non-linearity. And the most popular test against the star was actually suggested by Ritva Luukkonen. And this is something that Chris Brooks, it's a bit irritating for me that he doesn't discuss about this because these are the leading guys in this era. So the first paper was published by Ritva and Timo Terasvirta and others in Biometrica in 1988. And this actually raises a problem of so-called nuisance parameters, because all these parameters are not identified under the null. So they have to develop another or new test procedure to test for the validity of non-linearity. And they used so-called Taylor series approximator. You don't have to, once again, you don't have to pay attention to these things too much, because they are mathematically demanding things. If you are interested about those, go and take a look at the Biometrica paper in 1988, because that actually gives you the idea about testing for the non-linearity against the non-linearity, how to construct the relevant test procedures to test for that null hypothesis. So it can be shown that a test based on the first order approximation of the star model can be executed running this kind of auxiliary regressions. Once again, we won't go through this in too much detail. So if anyone of you is interested about this, the main idea is just to how is to test for the null hypothesis of linearity against non-linearity. When you are not aware of the specific form of non-linearity, so you are just testing against whether it would be relevant to have the model in the form of logistic smooth transition or to have it in the model of exponential smooth transition regression. So basically, here we have this first order condition, second order conditions, which actually imply the testing, and for the third order conditions here. So they are using basically Taylor series expansions to get these additional moments here for the y variable. So these are basically squared and up to the cubic root or the cubic, the power of three of the y variables in lax. So basically, they are now testing for the significance of these additional parameter estimates here. And they are deriving the distributions for these test statistics. Don't pay attention to those too much, because the main thing is that they are able to construct this kind of smooth testing strategy for the test statistics. So basically, in these testing procedures, everything is dependent on the lag structure very much. So how many lags do you have in the linear part of the model? How many lags you have for these guys here? What is the D value? And what is the number of lags or lagged observations in the linear part? So they are constructing these test statistics. And Terasvirta actually found out also that it's relevant to control for the heteroscedasticity also, obviously, in these test regressions. So don't pay too much to these things. So they can basically, you can adapt these to be based on these test statistics that are based on using these lags of these here. So don't pay too much to attention to these things. And here, for those of you that are interested in digging in more details about these structures, this is the one point where I actually encourage you to go and take a look at the RATS procedures and RATS codes, because originally Ritva Luukkonen and Timo Terasvirta, actually these procedures were originally coded in Gauss. Gauss program was the one that they started to use, and very soon after that, Tom Doan was actually one of the guys that it was also involved in developing these models, and he's the developer of the RATS, regression analysis of time series program. So RATS has been following these developments of these procedures quite closely. So if you want to familiarize yourself with in very details with these smooth transition autoregressive models, then I encourage you to go and take a look at the Estima website, because there the code is written by Tom Doan. It has been tested, so it's something that is actually manufactured, or it's provided by the Estima company. So it's tested for the validity. So it's a bit different case than, for example, in R. In case of R procedures or R packages, they are developed by the users. And in most cases, there's no one that is in charge for testing for the validity of these packages. So they might be their validities, but it is a bit more random thing than in case of these RATS programs. So this has been originally developed in RATS for the very starting paper by Ritva Luukkonen and Timo Teräsvinta and others. And it's available in Estima. So that Luukkonen et al. 1988 is referring to the fundamental, highly quoted paper in Biometrica. So there's an example code of RATS coding for estimating these smooth transition models and exponential smooth transit all exponential smooth transition models in this file called Skalin Teräsvilta, which is a paper that is published in Journal of Applied Econometrics in 1999. So if you are interested in using these models in more details and more, let's say, in a more fundamental way to understand what these estimation procedures actually are doing, in addition to the things that are being explained also when using R or STATA in the demonstration, go and take a look at the Estima codes or Estima page. So in that case, I would very much, if you're not able to go to the university and to the Africa classroom where we have the full license for the RATS, then download that free trial of 21 days of FinRATS from Estima and start doing these things from these codes that are given there. So I have here some instructions on how to run these codes and how to get the results of the paper in Journal of Applied Econometrics by Skalin and Teräsvilta. They are using Swedish data there. And you get the clear idea about what are these programs about. So here's a step-by-step explanation for that. And they are using this Taylor series approximation that Luukkonen and others derived there in the Biometrica paper for testing. And you are now, they are now constructing this null hypothesis for test of the first order interaction terms only. So it means that you are testing in this, you are here only testing for the relevance of these parameter estimates. Second order and third order is actually here, second and third order, and there's a final test also for the first and second order interaction terms only. So these are the null hypotheses that they derive. So basically based on this, in that paper, they actually prove that there's a set of null hypotheses that the exception of those gets to be interpreted as the approval of logistic L-star model or an E-star model. So if the null of linearity, which is the first here, basically, this is for the test of linearity against non-linearity. If it's rejected, and also the third null hypothesis gives a rejection, then the logistic star model is the appropriate one. So we can actually have a look at these original paper results there. If the null is rejected and the H12 is rejected, but the H3 or the null hypothesis for the third hypothesis, it's not rejected, then E-star model is the appropriate model. And they sort of give this idea. And this is valid for all the cases when you are interested about choosing between L-star or E-star models. So here they actually have the results. So basically, first line here refers to the null of linearity. So the first degree or the first stage tests, it's rejected here in this case for the Swedish data. And they also reject the second null hypothesis and also the third type. So here's the test for the linearity. That's the very first one there. You get to reject that at the 5% level clearly. This one doesn't get to be rejected because the p-value here is bigger than 0.1 even. The second hypothesis here gets to be rejected at 5% significance level. Third one doesn't get rejected at 5% significance level, but at 10% significance level, it does get rejected. And the final one here also, it actually gets to be rejected in all the significance level up to the level of 10%. So the significance levels of second is lower than that of third, then Skalin and Terasvita choose the E-star specification. All these choices here are carefully explained, actually, even more carefully explained than in the actual paper. They are explained here in the code. So Tom Tone pays a, he puts a lot of effort on explaining how to derive these null hypotheses for testing these things. And this is actually fairly easy also to do in Stata, but not so easy to do in R. So basically, this has been developed, or these results are based on RATS estimations, but you can do also this in Stata. And actually, this code is, or this paper is one example paper also in Stata manual. So you can take a look at this more closely. So in the actual estimation for Swedish GDB data, actually, the Terasvirta and Skalin used the original, instead of using the original transition function, they made a slight modification. This is a good example of the, let's say, the sensitivity of the choices between the representations of the models. So there are lots of things that are basically kind of ad hoc things here when we are using these logistic or exponential star representations of the data. So obviously, it's enough for you to just remember that the first thing that perhaps you should do is to test whether there is a linear representation or there is some kind of non-linear representation of the data. And then if it's easy to estimate the logistic representation for the data, you get the parameter estimates that are statistically significant or exponential, then choose one of those. But if it doesn't result into significant parameter estimates, then try something else. So basically, the thing that you should be trying in addition to these smooth transition models is actually the Markov switching models. And these are the ones that I would actually encourage also you to pay a lot of attention, because basically, these are the ones that are nowadays very sort of actively used when you model the financial market data. So if you are dealing or you are doing analysis that covers, or you are using macroeconomic data, then perhaps these smooth transition models might be relevant, because the dynamic dependencies might be regime dependent between the variables, and there might be sort of a longer history of observations that have relevance there for the other variables. But if you are focusing on a return type data, so your levels data has unit roots, and when you take differences of the levels resembling the first example that we actually discussed here today, when you take differences of the levels, they are stationary. So basically, in that case, you might be interested actually focusing also on the volatility of the series. And the Markov switching models have been developed also for the discussion of the volatility. Actually, that demonstration 5 actually nicely leads to this final conclusion that what are the relevant representations of the data that you should be actually focusing. My time or my computer clock is now 10:30, so I think that I have to take a cup of coffee now, so let's have a 10 minutes break once again, and let's be back here at 10:40, so 22:11. See you soon. Okay, so let's go now to this final theme of this course, and it's about the using of Markov switching models. What is a Markov switching, actually? So we have started this week's lectures discussion about these simple dummy variables approaches, which was just to design. It was designed to be used for revealing the role of specific observations or specific periods of observations in the data. So, for example, using the dummy variable approach, we can control for the specific effects of Friday observations for returns in a daily data set. So we put a special emphasis on that. And basically, these Markov switching models are a kind of a generalization of these simple dummy variable approaches. We want to control for the possibility that we are in a certain state or certain state in the data. So basically, there is a lot of possibilities of these states. You can define basically the probability of being in the upper quantile of observations, or probability of being in the second quantile, third quantile, fifth quantile, and so on. So basically, just based on the taking a look at the observations, how big are the values of those observations, you should be actually, or you could be focusing on specific observations. This is the idea basically in quantile type regressions, for example, where you do analysis for the biggest values, the biggest 10% or 20% of values. Are they correlated between the two sets of variables? Are the biggest observations from the general market index returns more correlated with the biggest or highest observations of, let's say, Nokia returns, for example? This is an example of quantile regressions. You could obviously also control for this using dummy variables. Define the returns from the highest quantile using the dummy and set the dummy to be 1 for those returns and 0 for all the others. But in general terms, Markov switching models or Markov models are designed to reveal the probability of being in those regimes based on your data. So once again, I very much would like to remind you that also when you are using Markov switching models, you should have some kind of interpretation for the various states. Why are you interested? What is the economic reasoning or economic explanation for giving special focus on these regimes? Once again, a beautiful example is this most recent euro area data series or observations from the money market interest rates, because this negative era is so peculiar. It's so interesting because it's something that's kind of an absurd thing that should not be there. It's in connection to the extreme monetary policy actions by the central banks, but we should get rid of those because nothing basically works in terms of standard discounting ideas, for example, during these negative interest rates. So one possibility to model also these things would be to use this Markov property or Markov switching models. So in general terms, we are focusing on the probability. P refers here to the probability that we get an observation, let's say for the Euribor 12-month interest rates, that is between some defined threshold values A and B. And we can get the probability, idea of the probability of being in that, within that threshold based on the past history of the observed variable, Euribor 12 months. So the past history is giving us an idea whether to be there or not. Obviously, for example, in the case of this negative interest rate era, it's not relevant to only include the variable or the observation from the negative era. If you're interested about the probability of getting to the positive era, because based on just past history, it's not possible to get to the positive era when you have only negative observations. But nevertheless, if you have observations from both regimes, both from positive regime and negative regime, then basically based on the behavior in the data train, how do the trends change in these interest rates? Is it possible to reveal or actually get an idea about the probability of getting to the positive observations? So Markov switching models give you a possibility to actually model this using these probability ideas. So in when you are using Markov switching models, all we need to forecast the probability that it will be, the variable will be in a given regime during the next period is the current period's probability and the transition probability matrix. So we write a general transition probability matrix for the probabilities of staying in that same regime. So these guys here in the diagonal elements are referring to the probabilities of staying in that regime. So if these are big, then basically there remains not very much things or probability to be present there for the all the other regimes. So this gives you an idea of the size of the probability for changing the regime from the first regime to the second regime. And here, when you are in the second regime, what is the probability of going back to the first regime? Obviously, once again, already for the discussion about the relevance of these regimes, you should bear in mind that what is your data? Is it relevant to try to figure out that there are, for example, different means for the interest rates in different regimes? For example, for this negative interest rate era, it might be actually interesting to analyze the possibility of three-regime Markov switching model. When you are able to define the regimes based on sort of a normal values for the positive interest rates and close to zero values, something that is between 1 and 0% at the positive side and then the negative side. So basically in that case, you would be interested about the probability of staying in the normal regime, very low positive interest rates and negative interest rates. What are the probabilities of staying there when you are there? What is the probability of staying there in the next period? But when you have been in a big or the normal period or normal interest rate level, what is the probability of changing towards the low positive values of interest rates? And if you are in the low positive value interest rate era, what is the probability of going to the negative? And currently, I would be very much interested in revealing what is the probability of going to the low level of positive values for the interest rates from these negative values of interest rates. That is the thing that I would encourage someone of you to take a look at using a Markov switching model, for example. So these can be, I should warn you that these models can be in terms of the calculation algorithms, they can be demanding, so they can be rather complex. But the simplest form of this is the so-called Hamilton's filter. So these are not very old models, actually. James Hamilton in 1990s, in his book 1994, actually gave the first textbook representation of these models. Well, they are over 25 years old already, but not so in terms of time series, history of time series models, not too old. So let's start from the simplest possible case where we have only two regime model. So the unobserved state variable here denoted as jet evolves according to a Markov process with the following probabilities. So this is something the probability in being in somewhere is it's not observable. You only have the actual observations. The value of those are actually dictating the possibility based on the whole sample observations that what is it reflecting? Is it reflecting regime one, for example, for positive interest rate, or is it reflecting regime two for negative interest rates? The main thing here is that you have an information about it for also for the last period. So the probability of staying in the first regime when you have been in the same regime in the previous period is denoted to be P11. Probability of moving to the second regime when you were in the first regime in the previous period is 1 minus P11. Probability of staying in the second regime when you were in the second regime in the previous period is P22. And probability of going to the first regime when you were in the second regime is obviously 1 minus P22. So these P11 and P22 are the smoothest probabilities of being in the regime 1, given that the system was in regime 1 during the previous period. And the probability of being in regime 2, given that the system was in that regime in the previous period. This is the general idea. So we are estimating something that is not unobserved based on the values of observed data. What is the probability of or the share of observations based on our whole sample of actual observations? What is the probability that this certain observation is now belonging to the regime one? And what is the probability of this certain observation to be in the regime two? So it's basically unobserved, but it's being dictated or it's being denominated by the actual values in the data series. So in case of that, for example, this Euribor 12-month interest rate data, we have clear observations. We have observations of those values. There are positive values and there are negative values. But based on the data, we would be interested in getting an idea whether it is probable that we will be in the next period, we will be going to the negative era, or we will be going to the positive era. So the past history of the observation has a role to do there in determining the probabilities of being there in a certain regime. So obviously it must be the case that over all the probability values, the sum should go to one because all the observations are in one of the regimes always. So we have a vector of current state probabilities to be defined as pi vector, where pi e is the probability that we are currently in state I. So obviously for these values, the relevant thing of interest or the threshold value is the 0.5. Is it bigger for the state one? Is it bigger than 0.5? Then you are in state one. If it's lower than 0.5, then you are in another state. In the case of the probability model or regime model for two regimes, you are in regime two. If the probability of staying in regime one is below 0.5. So given these individual probabilities for each states and the overall matrix of the probabilities, we can forecast the probability that we will be in a given state in the next period based on this overall probability matrix. So this is a conditioning. The conditioning information comes from the probabilities from the previous period, basically. And we can actually calculate these further along in the future, S steps into the future, just by updating that probability matrix to the power of s is, so we are, if you're calculating 10 steps ahead, we are raising to the power of 10, basically, that probability matrix. So Markov switching approach is very useful when the series is thought to be going, undergoing shifts from one type of behavior to another and back again. This might be problematic, for example, in these money market interest rate data, because it seems to be now that the negative era is more like a permanent arrangement at the moment. So it might be very difficult to actually try to forecast whether we are able to come to the positive era anymore using a Markov switching model. We absolutely need to have the positive observations also, but are there any trends in the negative era in the time structure of interest rates behavior that would be revealing ideas that we could get to some, at some future point, to the positive era once again? It's a big guess question whether you can reveal any kind of trends there that are speaking in favor of that. So if you are interested once again about the theory of these models, instead of individual papers in some journals, I encourage you very much to take a look at the Hamilton, James Hamilton book from 1994, Time Series Analysis. It's very nice representation of the theory of these Markov switching models, because he's basically the leading guy in these things. Now, as the final examples, I give you here two examples about using these Markov switching models, because they are the ones that I'm actually very much interested in at the moment, because they have this nice feature that they are usually, in many cases, they are applicable to the return series, and return series, at least at the highest frequencies, they are stationary, so they are behaving nicely in terms of the valid models. ARMA models, stationary representations are applicable, you can use those, and they are, the data generating process can be revealed to be stationary, but nevertheless there can be these regimes where, for example, the volatility of the returns is changing, so you can have high volatility returns here periods, and you can have low volatility of returns periods. So it's interesting to reveal whether you are able to forecast the movement to a low volatility period from a high volatility period. What is the probability? And is it different, for example, for different currencies, currency returns? Is it different for different stock market returns? Is it different for different interest yielding assets? These are very applicable in many, many cases. Here's an example of an application of Markov switching model, once again, to currency markets. So this is for the real exchange rate. So basically, the idea of purchasing power parity, that will be introduced to you in the international finance course, if some of you are not familiar with that one yet. It suggests that the law of one price should be applying in the long run. So immediately, based on the ideas that we have been discussing or the models that we have been discussing here in the course, the theme or the concept of long run should immediately give you an idea that perhaps it should be relevant to use co-integration analysis. So perhaps the first thing to do for the data would be to take a look at the unit roots. Do we have unit roots in the exchange rates? So are the log values of the levels of exchange rates, are they non-stationary? Can we form up a co-integration relationship between the different currency values? So is there some kind of long-run equilibrium relationship between those? And can we introduce that long-run relationship to a error correction model? So we would be in that case focusing actually on the changes of the log values of exchange rates, introducing the lags of those changes, and also this levels relationship, this co-integration relationship as a past term to the regression model. So these guys in this Berman and Hansson paper, it's very nice paper. So if you're interested about this modeling of real exchange rate behavior, it's a very good journal, also Journal of International Money and Finance. Take a look at this paper because it gives you nicely all the ideas about this stationarity, role of stationarity here in the purchasing power parity and possibilities of building up a co-integrating error correction model and so on. So under some assumptions, one implication of the purchasing power parity is actually that the real exchange rate, which means that the nominal exchange rate is divided by the general price index. So take a log value of the nominal exchange rate, divide that by the home currency CPI, consumer price index, log values of that. That is the definition for your real exchange rate. Focus on that. Do the unit truth tests for that variable. If it's stationary, then it actually implies to you that the purchasing power parity between these countries actually should be working. But in practical applications or in empirical research, it has been actually mostly found that it's not possible to reject this null hypothesis of non-stationarity in the real exchange rates. So basically, it implies that the purchasing power parity is not working. And this is definitely something that has collapsed also after the global financial crisis, because already the so-called covered interest rate parity between the nominal values of exchange rates has collapsed. So we have no reasons to believe that even the purchasing power parity would be holding in the most recent data from the currency markets. So this is once again very, very relevant theme to be analyzed, for example, in your thesis. It's widely known that the power of unit truth tests is low, which means that you actually might be accepting a wrong null hypothesis too often. And in the unit truth tests, usually, for example, in the ADF test, we have the null hypothesis to be that there is the unit truth. So if there is a structural change, big spike, or frequent spikes in the data, it can disturb your inference from the unit truth tests. It can actually induce the behavior to the series that would be resembling unit truths, even though there are no unit truths actually. So if you clean up the effects of these kind of outlier type or regime change type occasions in the data series, and then do the unit truths for the cleaned data series, filtered data series, there's actually no unit truth. And this finding actually gave the reasons for Berryman and Hansson also to try to estimate a Markov switching model with an AR1 structure for the real exchange rate. So basically, they didn't believe their a priori results that there is a unit truth. They wanted to question that finding. Is it really possible that there is a unit truth in the real exchange rate? So they started to do this analysis, and the linear part of the model is the simplest possible one. It's an AR1 with a constant term. So basically, if this actually gets to be estimated, this phi parameter estimate close to one, you have a random walk with drift if this also gets to be estimated statistically significantly. And that would be actually resembling the idea that you really have the unit truth there in the data generating process. So they first calculate that real exchange rate values, and they calculate it for several currencies, but they want to analyze the possibility that if the real exchange rate, if it experiences various regimes, so it's either in a high real exchange regime and it's in a low real exchange regime, it might be behaving also in terms of the possibility of unit truths in a different way. So their state variable is assumed to be following a two-regime Markov process. So they, based on this data generating process for the real exchange rate, they want to condition that to the level of the real exchange, actually? Is it relevant to reveal the different means and different variances for the real exchange rates in different regimes? So they use quarterly observations from 1973 until 1997, and they are using the data, real exchange data, always against the US dollar for UK, France, Germany, Switzerland, Canada, and Japan. So this is just before the launching of the euro area, or the third stage of the European Monetary Union. It's estimated for the first 72 observations, and the remainder, once again, they want to use this for forecasting purposes. So they want to use the remainder of the observations for the auto-sample forecast evaluation. They use 100 times the log change in the real exchange rate. So basically they are not log changes, but the log values of the real exchange rate. So they are not using returns, but basically it's a percentage thing in this case that they want to focus on. And this is normalized to take a value of 1 for 1973 in comparisons between different countries or different markets. This is the usual case when we try to analyze various, usually a specific parity condition. So normalize the first observation to take the value of 1. So basically everything that starts to develop after that, it's in comparison to that normalized value. How do the development of real exchange rate in the UK, how does it behave compared to the real exchange behavior of Germany when it started from the same thing, same parity condition at the first observation? So this is the usual thing to do in many comparable cases when you use international data between countries or between markets and so on. So they get the results here. What can you say about these results? Can you say that it is relevant to use a Markov switching model? That's the first question. Mu 1 refers to the first regime mean value. So it refers to the AR representation's mean value here in the first regime, and mu 2 in the second regime. And this theta here refers to the value of the AR parameter in the first regime. Or the in general, when you have extracted the differences in the mean, and the variance is there also measured. So the variance of the error term in this regression model is that delta squared, sigma squared. And then the probabilities of staying in the first regime and the probability of staying in the second regime are the things here. So to your mind, is it relevant? The first question is that, is Markov switching modeling here relevant?
Yes, because the estimates are quite different for different regimes.
Yeah, exactly. So you're focusing here, one of the first information or the critical things here is the difference between the means, sample means. So basically, what does this refer to when you are considering this as the valuation of the currency against the US dollar? What does a positive mean for the first regime here refer to? Are we in a depreciating or appreciating regime? Positive mean here means that it's more expensive in general, in average terms, in this regime to buy dollars with pound, for example. So in case of Japanese currency, we actually get, first of all, not statistically significant. These are once again error terms, so these are not t-statistics in the parentheses. But in the Japanese case, for this data period, actually, it's interesting to see that it's not even possible to statistically reveal a period of depreciation in the Japanese yen, because this is not statistically significantly different from zero, and the parameter estimate actually for the first regime is of the same sign as it is for the second regime. And this was actually the period of Japanese yen of being experiencing a very strong period of appreciation against each and every other currency. So basically for all the other, except perhaps for the case of Canada, it is really, really relevant in terms of the statistical significantly different mean values in the AR representation to reveal this Markov switching property in the data generating process of real exchange rates. Because this really refers to the period of depreciation in the home currency against the US dollar, and the second regime is really a period of appreciation. I will explain, Juha-Matti and Alexander will also explain in the idea of depreciation and appreciation in the demonstrations, but obviously you should understand it that it, when the value of the your home currency against the US dollar, when it's increasing, it's more expensive to buy the unit of US dollar. So your home currency is depreciating. So that is the reason why the positive values here refer to the depreciation and negative values for the constant term here refer to the appreciation period. The thing that is of interest here in terms of the Markov switching model is also that probability of staying in the depreciation period and also in the appreciation period when you are there are actually quite low, except for the cases of Canada and Japan. So basically these results for the probability of staying there in the regime are also resembling these results there in the means actually, because these are very high. When you are in the regime of appreciation, you are very likely to stay there also in the next period, and vice versa. When you are in the regime of depreciation, you are very likely to stay there. But for all the other currencies, it's also actually very quite possible that you will be moving to somewhere else. You will be moving to the next regime when you are in the P1 or you are in the regime 1. Because this actually leaves the value for 1 minus P11, which is the P12. Probability of going to the second regime when you have been in the first regime is actually almost 0.33. So it's actually quite a big possibility that you would be. So it's there are a lot of changes between the regimes in the probability series. So that's actually varying quite a lot for all these other. So it's very relevant to actually X3. If you want to use for forecasting purposes, it's very relevant for these four cases actually to use Markov switching model. That is one of the main results. So the model is able to separate the real exchange rates into two distinct regimes for each series, with the intercept in regime one being positive for all countries except Japan. And Japan was very Japanese yen was very strong in during that period. So there's a rise in the lock of the number of units of the foreign currency per US dollar. So depreciation of the domestic currency against the dollar. Sorry, this should be domestic, not foreign, but domestic. And the U2 here refers to the regime 2. It's negative, so it's referring to the appreciation of the domestic currency against the US dollar. So the thing here to be taking a closer look at are these probabilities for the regimes one and two. What are the probabilities of staying there? So what are the smoothed probabilities? They are fairly low for UK, France, and Germany. So that indicates actually quite a lot, big number of changes between the regimes. from one regime to another for those currencies, but not for the cases of Canada and Japan, actually. When we allow for the switching intercepts across these regimes, the AR1 coefficient is considerably distanced below. So basically, we get a more stationary representation now for the case when we allow for this emergence of these different regimes. So this is not resembling now the problem of unit root anymore. So it's actually essential to reveal the structural changes in the form of Markov switching model for the real exchange rate to get the stationary representation for the deterministic part of the model. You don't have the unit root problem there basically anymore. This gets to be estimated clearly lower. And also in these cases where actually it was not so clear that it's sensible or it's meaningful to detect these different regimes. But the AR part here is actually performing quite well in terms of stationarity. So they got an idea that perhaps the purchasing power parity might hold after all. It's not stationary. It's not non-stationary. The real exchange rate series, so the purchasing power parity might hold after all. And they find that for none of these cases can the unit root null hypothesis be rejected in the original data, even though the null is clearly wrong. So basically, they sort of find the main result that it's wrong to accept a falseful null of unit root, so that the purchasing power parity would not be working if you have these kind of structural changes in the data. So it's very essential to control for these, because the theory might be actually working because the data generating process of these observations or these variables is actually you can have a stationary representation for that if you control these structural changes in an appropriate way. Markov switching modeling could be used for that. And they use this Markov switching AR model for forecasting the remainder of the exchange rates in the sample compared to the predictions produced by the random walk. So the random walk is now imposing the unit root property there. So they are imposing that the AR1 coefficient is 1. And also they want to experiment with the Markov switching model with the random walk. So they still force their AR1 to be coefficient to be 1 and still impose the Markov switching model. And they find that for all these 6 series and for forecast horizons up to 1 year ahead, Markov switching model produces predictions with the lowest mean squared error. So the Markov switching model, actually, when you take into account the structural changes in the form of Markov switching model, it produces more efficient forecasts. So they are really statistically significant also, the improvements over this pure random walk. So it's wrong. The basic result is that it's wrong to assume that there is the unit root when there is actually structural changes that cause a unit root-like behavior to the data generating process. And when you parameterize these structural changes using a Markov switching model, you are actually able to beat the unit root-based forecasting model when you impose this Markov switching structure to a stationary AR model, actually. So that's actually proves out to be a useful thing. And this is actually in many cases that when you apply these Markov switching models to the currency market data, you actually are able to produce better out-of-sample forecasts. But it's relevant to detect the number of regimes, first of all, and then also to choose a relevant comparison or the benchmark model for your forecast exercises. The second application is here for the use of so-called guilt equity ratio. This is another thing that would be very interesting to analyze in the modern data, because we have now observations for negative interest rates or negative government bond yields. and extremely extreme variations in the dividend yields. So remind yourself what are the difference, how do you calculate dividend yields? Dividend yields are the division of dividends by the valuation of the stocks in the market. So the higher is the valuation of stocks, the lower is the dividend yield. Assuming that the dividend stream is fairly stable, because it should be based on the real performance of the firms, how well are they able to pay dividends for their owners. So the dividend yield goes lower when the valuation of the stock increases, and vice versa. Now that we have observed negative government bond yields, for example, for the Finnish government bonds, it would be actually extremely interesting to analyze whether these kind of gilt equity ratios have structurally changed strongly after the quotation of negative bond market yields. This is once again very strange thing that has appeared immediately after the central bank started to do their unconventional monetary policy actions and started to buy the government bonds to their balance sheets. So that is actually, this is a really interesting thing. So if you want to do this kind of analysis, take a look at this Brooks and Persson paper that has appeared in the journal International Journal of Forecasting in 2001. Take that as a basis for your modeling ideas. Take the data from the most recent observations, for example, for the euro area, some core euro area countries, and for example, Finland, and calculate these gilt equity yield ratios as ratios of income on of the income yield on long-term government bonds, so the yield on government bonds divided by the dividend yield on equities. So it's easy to calculate. You can get all the data, for example, from DataStream very easily. And it has been suggested that the current value of the gilt equity yield ratio might be a useful tool for investment managers or market analysts. Question is that, is it a useful tool for them anymore when you have these negative government bond yields? So it's assumed to have a long-run equilibrium level. So deviations of that are taken to be an indication of that equity prices are at an unsustainable level. Obviously, we have a case here that equity prices might be at an unsustainable level. Main reason for that is that central banks are doing these unconventional monetary policy actions and the liquidity is going to the stock markets. It's not going to the banking sector, to the real investments. Actually, it's going to the stock markets. So what is the role of unconventional monetary policy actions period in disturbing this long-run equilibrium idea of gilt equity ratio? Very interesting theme. So in its crudest form, an equity trading rule based on the gilt equity ratio would say that if the gilt equity ratio is low, then buy equities. And if the gilt equity ratio is high, sell equities. You can get even an economically or financially oriented null hypothesis that what is the effect of unconventional monetary policy actions regarding this kind of trading rule or trading suggestion. Now in this paper, Brooks and Persson use the monthly stock index dividend yield. So you can get this for most recent observations, obviously from DataStream directly. You can get it for these countries actually. And you could, this would be a very interesting setting in terms of the relevant countries, because UK has now departed from the Europe. Brexit has now, is reality now. They also had very low and even negative steering rates in monetary policies, and the government bond yields are very low. And we have these observations, especially for Germany, the government bond rates are negative and valuation in the stock markets are really, really high. So it would be very, very interesting thing to take a look at now. They plot these time series plot for the gilt equity ratios for each and every countries, and they observe these spikes. So basically, it should be the case that if you are in an equilibrium situation, these spikes should not occur. And the interesting thing is that are these spikes in connection to the changes, huge changes in the valuation of stocks? And my claim is for the most recent data that there are now huge changes in these developments of these gilt equity ratios that are in connection to the quotation of, first of all, negative government bond yields, and also to the emergence of the buying programs of the central banks that are in connection to those, and also to the valuation of stock prices. This is really, really interesting thing that you, some of you should perhaps take a look at. If you start to take a look at, draw first the distribution of this gilt equity ratio that you are focusing on, if you find this kind of behavior, so it's not normal. Normal distribution is here drawn also as a comparison, and this is nothing like normal. It's actually quite strongly left skewed here. So there is a kind of a big mass here on the right-hand side, actually, and you could actually be discussing about the possibility of having two kind of a peaks here in the distribution. Perhaps not a peak here, but there's clearly a change here around the value of minus two. So distribution is not normal. It does have non-normality behavior, so non-linear models might be relevant. It might be relevant to use, for example, Karch models. It might be relevant to use Markov switching models. It might be relevant to use star models or anything else than normal or linear representations for the gilt equity ratio. So they estimate a Markov switching model, and they find these kinds of results. They first of all estimate once again a two-regime Markov switching model, basically the same kind of ideas than in the previous paper. So you are interested about whether there are differences in the values of the mean terms. So are there, for example, for the UK and US?
Yes.
Yes, there are, and especially for the German case, you have really big differences. You can actually test for the difference of these mean values. So, for example, if I'm posing the null hypothesis that the mean value of German in period one is exactly the same as it is in period two, then construct a t-statistics for 3.02 minus 2.1 5 divided by the standard error, so you can get the test statistics whether these are equal or not. So the difference between these those should be statistically different from zero. And also the variances, especially in the case of the variances, you have clearly results here that the variances are clearly different in these different regimes. So there are strong differences between the variances, especially for the German case. The volatility of this gilt equity ratio in the first regime is clearly, clearly higher, even though the mean value is perhaps in absolute terms is not so much higher, but the volatility is 50 times than the in the second regime. Here are the probabilities of staying in the individual regime, so they are actually quite big. So it perhaps indicates to you that there's not very much variability. When you are in a certain regime, you are probable to stay there also. But also when you go to the second regime, the probability of staying there also is quite high. So when you change, you are there for a longer period. And when you change back, you are once again there for a longer period. And it is actually very relevant to detect these two regimes because the number of observations in these two regimes are actually quite big. So if you are comparing this to, for example, the limit of at least 15% to have observations in each of the of the whole observations to be in each of the different regimes, it's actually relevant in all the cases to be able to detect these two regimes. So it's clear that the regime switching model has split the data into two distinct samples, one with a high mean and one with a lower mean. And another thing is that there are much more volatile or variability in the observations at times when it's in the high mean regime for UK, German and German gilt equity ratio. And there's this high variance that is an indication of that. And the number of observations for which the probability at the gilt equity ratio is in the high mean state exceeds 0.5. So this 0.5 is the relevant threshold value for these probabilities. So it's 102 for the UK, 37% of the total, while for the US it's 36.8, and for Germany 73.5. So it's really, really relevant to detect these different regimes. The gilt equity ratio is more likely to be in the low mean regime for the UK and US, while it is likely to be in high regime for the Germany. I would be very happy to see that someone of you would do this analysis for the more recent data for exactly these gilt equity ratios for these three main countries, and focusing especially on the role of negative bond yields, government gilt yields, and for the role of extension of central bank's balance sheet, because that's in connection to the huge increase in the stock prices, stock market valuation. It would be really interesting to find out whether you are able to extract from the gilt equity ratio clearly different regimes in relation to these things. So my idea is that actually is the unconventional monetary policy actions, are they actually inducing purely speculative behavior to the markets, and what is the role of actually intervening by the central banks into the government markets or government bond markets also? Because that's the reason why we now have these negative yields in the government bond markets. So these are really, really interesting results. So basically, I would very much encourage you to, someone of you, take a look at, also you can take this, it would be nice to see a very thorough analysis, for example, in your home assignment regarding these things. So if you want to do that, gather the data. But in other cases, if you're not interested in doing your home assignment using the data for your own research, for example, for your master's thesis, I will be downloading tomorrow exact details or instructions about how to do the home assignments. I'm done with the lecturing here, and Juha-Matti and Alexandra will be going through the last demonstration questions. We have only three questions there, basically, but they are kind of really kind of up-to-date questions about the things that we have now observed in the currency markets in the most recent data. And they should give you an idea about the controlling for the relevance of the extreme observation and structural changes in the data generating processes. And do they help for forecasting, for example? So you will be trying various forms of these switching models that we have been discussing this week. And one of the assignment or parts of the assignment instructions will be to try to fit any kind of switching model to the data that you are analyzing in the home assignment. So basically, the home assignment is designed to serve as a kind of a starting or kick-off for you if you are planning to do this kind of analysis in your master's thesis, for example. And for those of you that have no idea what to do in your master's thesis yet, Most of you are first year banking and international finance students. So don't get panicked, because I will give very detailed new data sets to do also all these things. Just focus on the interpretation of the results. Do the things as they have been instructed. You can do everything based on the demonstrations that you have been given. And you can use R, you can use Stutter. If some of you has previously been encountered with other programs like SAS, for example, or Python, you can always also use those, but you always have to provide exact codes and the data, so that I can replicate the things that you have done, because I will check all the things. But the more detailed instructions about the home assignment will be given to you tomorrow. Does anyone have any questions?
I also have a question.
Go ahead.
Okay, was it Ville? I think Ville was first.
Okay. Yeah, eli, as you got me convinced during the last lecture about the superiority of the Karch family models combined with these regime switching models, could you please explain why we assume normality in the return series error term in Karch models, and does the regression results inference take into consideration the data generating process, third and fourth moments?
Well, that's a good question. Usually the third and fourth moments are not being encountered in these models. And the idea of getting the normally distributed residual series from the final stage when you have fitted the Karch model is, for example, the Karch model, is the thing that you are aiming towards. So you start from the non-normally behaving residual. So if you specify the model in the linear form and you are able to prove that it's actually not a linear representation, you have to also control for the non-linearity. And after you have controlled for the non-linearity and you get the standardized residuals based, for example, on Karch model and test for the normality in those, they should be more normally behaving. But there are also models that take into account the third and fourth moments parametrically. We have not discussed those, but if you are especially interested about those models, then I can give you references for those also. But in terms of standard theoretical models for example, asset pricing models, there's basically capital asset pricing model doesn't speak anything about the third moment or the fourth moment, actually. So it's all about expected returns and variances. So the second moment is the thing where we end up. But it might be actually relevant, especially during extreme periods of time, to control for the role of third moment. But in terms of efficient allocation, what would that indicate to you in terms of mean variance allocation or mean variance based allocation questions? When you try to minimize the risk with an expected return or maximize the returns with a given risk. So what is the role of third or fourth moment in that? So basically, these are not parameterized here in these models. We are stopping there to the second moment. We try to model the behavior of the second moment the best possible way. And if it's based on the behavior of the linear part residuals, so then you are using Karch models, basically. So basically, this non-linearity behavior that we draw here, you can try to capture its effect. Here you have the data. So this is a non-linear, this is non-normally behaving data. And you can try to capture this non-normality in a parametric way by using, for example, Markov switching models. But it's basically, as you see here, the highest moment that we are considering here is the second moment. So we are not calculating actually the third moment values. We are not calculating a skewness parameters or kurtosis parameters or kurtosis value for these different regimes. So if you want to take a look at those, there is some literature that is also focusing on this one, but it's even more difficult to model using the third and fourth moments. Was I able to clarify anything to you?
Yes. And one question also, considering the CARTS models, when the CARTS mean model is the most obvious model to use?
When is it? Did you have a question, when is it the most obvious? You cannot basically detect that from the raw data. You have to check for the validity whether the mean parameter there is relevant or not. That's the only way basically. It's not usually very easy to reveal from the raw data whether the GARCH in mean process is relevant. Do you have some kind of mean in the volatility series that should be parameterized there? You have to test for that and test that against the null hypothesis that there's no role for the mean.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Kimmo has also something.
Yeah, first one regarding the Markov-Swiecin models. When we have those probabilities about switching to another regime, are those probabilities, if we are in one regime, is it always the same probability? Or is the probability that is announced some kind of average? So does it depend that where are we in one regime?
Yeah. It depends on the past observation of the probability. That's the main idea. So it's basically time varying. So you can draw the probabilities of staying in one regime against another. That's the richness, or that's the beautiness of these models, that you can draw the so-called smoothest probability, that what is the probability to stay in regime one over time, and what is the probability of staying in regime two over time. And the conditioning information comes from the previous probability where you have been previously. And obviously, if there comes a big change in the actual observed observations, so remember that the actual observed observations are the real conditioning probability for, or conditioning information for the probabilities of regime. So if there comes a big change and it's like kind of a permanent change, then it induces the probability of change also in the regime. And if you have lots of observations from the new regime in the actual series, then the probability of staying in that regime also increases, because the past history of all the observations, the actual observations is now giving you an idea that the previous probability has been also quite high to stay there, so the next probability is going to be also quite high. So the interesting things here are actually these time varying, these probability series for the smoother probabilities to stay in that regime. How long do they stay high and when do they come down? And are these periods of high values for staying in certain probability, are they in connection in a sort of a static way to the actual observations that you are using for the variables, for the variable that you are using as an information variable? So, for example, if you take this, I have been discussing now quite a lot about this unconventional monetary policy things. So the information variable there is actually the extension of the balance sheet of the central bank. It's at some points, like during the last year, 2020, it was exponential from March onwards. It started actually in February, and it has been extending all the time. So if you take a look at the time series of the balance sheet extension of the central banks, is it actually relevant to try to detect at least two, probably even three regimes there? Is there a regime one where it's kind of a normal? So the unconventional monetary policy, the huge buy-in programs of government and other assets by the central banks are now the new norm. There is no change, perhaps, in the new norm, not a big change in those buying programs, but when there comes a kind of a upward trend that is not an exponential trend, but it's more like a linear trend, then perhaps that is reflecting a new era of more unconventional monetary policy actions. And when it turns to an exponential change, can we actually detect based on, for example, Markov switching models, that it's now reflecting the probability of being in an extremely unconventional monetary policy regime? So the more you have observations from an exponential rise in that, the more probable you are that you are in this extreme unconventional monetary policy action. So basically that would be reflecting the three regime Markov switching model for the extension of the central bank's balance sheets. Is it possible to do that? I have no idea, but it would be interesting to take a look at that. So if you are, after you have calculated these probabilities, smoothed probabilities for staying in the normal, unconventional and extremely unconventional, are the probabilities of those extremely unconventional observations, regimes, are they somehow, do they form a kind of a regime that seems to be holding exactly when the central bank balance sheet is exponentially increasing? And does it drop to the more normal level after that? Is it possible to forecast actually somehow using Markov switching models that when you are in extremely unconventional, when you are like unconventional, and when you are in a conventional regime? So it's a time varying thing. And the interesting thing is actually these time graphs for these probabilities of being in a certain regime. These are the mean values that are get to be reported here. So these are the kind of values for staying, at which probability when you are there, what's the mean value for that over all the observations, and when you are in a second regime, what's the mean value for that in over all the observations. So how likely is it that you will be staying there? So when you are calculating the, for example, in this case, when you are calculating for the UK data of probability to moving from first regime to the second one, that's obviously 1 minus P11. When you are in the second regime, when you are calculating the probability of going from second to the 1 in the overall sample, that's 1 minus 0.97. So they are quite low. When you are in that regime, the probability of staying in that regime is very high. But it doesn't sort of rule out the probability at all that you would be going to another. But when you go to another, there's not much of observations of switches between regime, but there are lots of observations in about staying in that regime when you are there. Do you understand, Kimmo, this now?
Yeah, I got it.
Okay, good. It's good that you are interested about this, because these are the most useful models actually for many cases in the current data.
And I actually had another question. So when we try to create a model and try to test its forecasting power, should we not only estimate the parameters in sample, but also specify the model in sample rather than using the whole sample to specify the model?
That's the so-called real out-of-sample exercise. Yeah, I understand completely your question. In the literature, it's usually has been the way that they have been imposed. I completely understand your question in terms of actually these SETAR models, for example, when you have a possibility to specify a different AR model for the different regime. So there's no reason to assume that the when you are doing these auto-sample exercises, that actually the model would be exactly the same in the out-of-sample. It can change, actually. But usually it's actually something that it's referring now to the possibility of strong structural change in the data generating process. So it's actually, you would be sort of in introducing double problems to your modeling, because you have to basically somehow be able to characterize the true model for the whole data. And the thing that is the first step towards making things more complicated is to allow the model to be time varying with respect to the parameter estimates. So you are using the same structure for the model for all the observations, but the parameter estimates can change based on the new observations. So you are using basically rolling or recursive observations. And then you are assuming that you have the same parametric representation, but you are just testing for the auto-sample performance. But usually you refer to the case where we have different benchmarks, actually. Am I to understand you correctly? Because the benchmark are different models, actually. Usually a benchmark model is an AR1 or ARMA11 or something like that, or it's a random walk or something like that. So it's a completely different model, actually. So that's actually the reason why we want to stick to the same model for the out-of-sample period also, because we have a benchmark model against which we are comparing. If we would be changing the structure of our model that we are contesting, actually, also for the out-of-sample forecast period, then actually we are imposing unnecessary problems in terms of choosing the best possible model originally. So we try to make use of the whole data in deciding the best possible model, but we are now giving the possibility in terms of out-of-sample forecasting exercises that the model might not be equally good as is an alternative model for the whole sample. Do you understand this?
Maybe.
So basically, how would you determine for only the auto-sample period? What would be your basics to determine the new model for that? Usually you have a smaller number of observations in the auto-sample exercise. So basically you would run into troubles in terms of estimating the right model. So usually it's easier for you to just compare to something as a benchmark. So let's assume that you are, in the simplest possible case, you are estimating an ARMA22 model for the whole sample, and then you are contesting whether that is a good out-of-sample forecasting model. So you first test for the performance of the model by skipping, for the estimation, you skip a certain amount of observations from the end of the sample and then try to forecast for the rest of the observation and compare to the actual values. You get the statistics for the goodness of forecasts, compare those to some other model, like for example AR1. Estimate that same AR1 model, get the parameter estimates, and then use that AR1 model for the in-sample and then do the out-of-sample forecasting exercise and compare the obtained forecast statistics to the model that you originally started, the ARMA22 model. Because it would be, basically, if you want to change the structure of the models basically all the time in sub-samples, when there you are in deep troubles there, because these individual structural changes can actually introduce completely new parameterizations for the model. And these are just, these switching models are kind of steps towards trying to capture the role of individual observations, whether they are causing permanent structural changes or are they indicators of regimes, new regimes that stay there for a period of time and then you come back to something else. But always the conditioning information is the actual observation of the series.
Yeah, I understood. my thought behind the question was that like in reality we don't have the future data so that we could make a model.
And that's exactly. And that's actually the interesting thing, actually, that if you are using, for example, well, let's say that you are using a model up until the end of 2020, for example, and we don't have observations for 2021 at all, but you still want to forecast. You can obviously do that, but you don't have anything to compare against. You can only have the comparisons ex post after you have lived this year. You have lived January and February, for example, and then you are only after that able to record the actual observations and compare to your forecasting. But you can obviously try to forecast. And this is the thing that the market participants are actively doing all the time. They want to use these kind of a time series structural models to forecast the future volatility and future excess returns and future correlations between these things. And they are only able to compare those to the actual values after they have lived their new periods or observed the new observations. So this is relevant question, because usually, yes, exactly, we use these for out real life out of sample forecasting. But when we want to compare the forecast performance, it's not possible to do when we don't have the actual observations yet. You can only do the forecast comparison exercises only after you have the actual forecasts. So you can get an indication whether really in outdoor sample exercise, perhaps ARMA-2-2 model would be a better than AR-1 model if it has performed in the most recent history. It has performed better than the AR-1, then it might be likely also performing in the near future really out of sample. So you might be able to build up a trading strategy that is giving you better returns based on ARMA-2-2 against ARMA-1 or AR-1.
Yeah, and I have one last question.
Okay.
So if we have normally distributed residuals, or for example returns, variance is kind of pretty good way to measure the risk, but if we have like a heteroscedastic variance or like a regime changing model, do we have a way of measuring the risk in one number, for example, that considers the risk of the change of regime, which would lead to a higher variance?
Yeah, basically, because you can calculate the risk measure, you can calculate the volatilities under using these parameterizations for the models. So as here, for example, we have different risks, we have different variances in different regimes. So basically, you can compare these. So you can calculate the modified or the risks or the variances for the variable that you are interested in. In this case, we are not actually focusing. Well, we are focusing here to one kind of return, actually. So the riskiness of gilt equity ratio is clearly different. You can calculate ex post that by imposing these parameter estimates to the calculation of volatility. So for example, in using these Markov switching cards models, you will be using these with R in the last question of next exercise or the demonstration. So you will get an idea about how to calculate these implied. These are not implied, basically. These are the standardized risk measures or the volatilities based on these parameterization of these models. So here you can compare, for example, of the riskiness in the first regime of the UK gilt equity ratio compared to the US. So, and it's in the US case, it's clearly it is smaller. But in the second regime in the US case, it's clearly higher. So these are sort of conditional volatilities, conditional on the information that is being used for the estimation of that volatility in the first regime and second regime.
Okay, but like if we are in the UK and we are in the second regime, we have these variance, and if you use that as a risk measure, it doesn't take into account that it might a regime change might happen, and then we would have a higher variance.
Exactly. So do we have any way
to measure the risk?
Well, basically, you can actually calculate the risk also so you want to actually calculate the risk at the points when you are changing the regimes. Am I understanding it right? Because that might have a role, that might have a big effect, actually. So basically, you can only get an inference about the probability of changing value in the risk when you take a look at these probabilities of staying in that regime. When you draw these probabilities of staying in that regime against the probability of staying in that other regime, then you can pinpoint the points in the time when also the riskiness might be changing. Because these have been calculated for the values of staying in the regime one and staying in the regime two for all the observations in your sample. But obviously, once again, if you want to do an out-of-sample forecasting exercise, forecast the volatility in the near future, but you have only information about the past probabilities of the regimes, then you might be ending up forecasting a wrong regime. So basically also your forecast of the volatility would be wrong if you are ending up to a wrong forecast of the volatility, forecast of the regime. So you can expose when you have the data. Once again, I think that you are referring to the possibility of forecasting the riskiness in the near future. Am I right? Based on this Marco switching idea. Yes. You can do that. You can try to do that. But once again, I want to remind you about the actual behavior of data. What is the recent observations of the data? Is it likely that the guilt equity ratio is going to be staying in that regime? If there is a huge change in that guilt equity regime for one reason or other, and reasons nowadays might be in connection, for example, to the sudden increased need for doing more unconventional monetary policy. Let's say that it turns out to be that the vaccine is not working. We are getting more alarming news about the vaccine's power. Is it reliable? Can you use it for elderly people? Is it really preventing the disease? So it's one indicator of increasing uncertainty, and it might be the case that it's actually will be seen also if we get more bad news about the real effect of the vaccine, then it's actually something that induces more uncertainty to the economy, and unconventional monetary policy actions might increase once again, and ECB might even start to be buying these euro level new bonds that are needed basically for this rescue program or rescue mechanism after the corona crisis, then it actually might induce also a huge change in this guilt equity ratio. So it will be inducing a change in the probability of being in the certain regime, and it will also induce a change in the volatility of the guilt equity ratio.
Yes. Yeah.
So the main thing is always here that when you are sort of extracting ex post from the data, the probabilities of being in certain regime, whether it's a Markov switching regime for these actual series like it is in this case, or it can be also Markov switching model for the GARCH part. So for the riskiness, you will be actually doing as an out of interest exercise. We have not been discussing about Markov switching in GARCH, but you will be given an example of that because it's nowadays very, actually not so easy, but it's accessible in R, not in Stata, but you can do it in R because in 2019, a new package was introduced to estimate Markov switching charge models, then you would be modeling the Markov switching process in the RISC. And that is actually probably the thing that you are asking here. It is also possible to model the Markov switching regime changes in the RISC, in the CARCH specification. And that should actually take care of the rest of the non-normality in the modeling of the variance when you're using GARCH. Is it relevant to reveal different regimes in the volatility? And you will be seeing in that currency market data on Monday that it is actually possible to try to reveal different regimes in the GARCH process of the Japanese yield returns. Okay.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Okay, any other questions from others? I'm very happy to see that it seems to be the case that you are interested about these things. This course in general might seem to be a fairly demanding course for those of you that don't have a background from doing econometrics at an intermediate level or any kind of statistics or mathematical courses, but the point of view has been right from the beginning in the applications. So the main thing for me is from the part of view to be able to reveal that you are able to understand these concepts and use the programs to do the estimations and most of all do the interpretation of the results in economics sense or financial theory sense. That is it relevant to use this model? What is the statistical fit? What does it implicate in terms of economic interpretation or financial interpretation? Does the model hold based on your econometric analysis? Okay, thanks. If there's no other questions, it has been a pleasure to give these lectures, even though I really, really don't like this remote lecturing mode. I would have very much liked to be there in the classroom with you, but perhaps next year it is possible once again, but it doesn't help to help you. But I hope that this recording of these all lectures and demonstrations will make up some of the lost benefits in doing this in classrooms. Okay, so tomorrow I will post I will download the instructions for doing the home assignments, and on Monday you will have the final demonstration, and after that we will actually organize once a week an online help that is being given by Alexandra for a couple of hours sessions, so you can give questions regarding the practical implementation or practical or technical things in connection to doing the things or doing the model estimations and so on. But I should warn you that Alexandra will not give you any guidance in terms of the interpretation of the results. That is something that you have to do yourself. You have to be able to understand or give me a clear indication that you are able to understand the things that you have estimated and the inference. Is there a statistical significance or not? And if it's there, what does it indicate in terms of the phenomenon that you are analyzing there? In economic terms or financial terms. Okay, good. I wish you a pleasant rest of the week, and let's hope that we will be able to meet somewhere in the near future. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.